There is not a square inch in the whole domain of our human existence over which Christ, who is sovereign over all, does not cry, "Mine."
Hello, everybody, and welcome to today's episode of Nuance, and we are going to the military corner of the public square. I've got one of my good buddies, David McKinney, who's here and going to talk with us about his career in the Navy and how his faith both guided him or how he even struggled or flourished in this major institution with worldwide impact. You know, we live in a world of conflict. And war is both a reality today, and it has been through human history. And so you might wonder, well, how do we understand our nation's defense and armed forces as Christians? I come from a military family, and I'm very proud of that. I hold military service in high regard. But, you know, there is a pacifist stream within Christianity. So what is a Christian to do when it comes to serving in the military in which violence inevitably occurs? Well, I'm Case Thorpe, and welcome. Remember, please like, subscribe, and share this episode. It really helps us to expand our reach. Now, if you've been listening last couple episodes, you know we're doing something a little new in the collaborative. We've widened our scope from just faith and work more to the public square and how a Christian's faith impacts culture. And so I've got biweekly guests who will help us to speak on such topics. Don't forget, we've also got a new 10-minute episode for spiritual formation called Formed for Faithfulness. Hope you're enjoying those. Well, David McKinney, hey man, thanks for being here.
Doctor.
Admiral.
That was a lofty rank that I never achieved.
Yes, yes. Well, so long time no see, right?
Been way too long. What, we're like a mile or two from each other?
And, you know, we see each other almost daily at the First Pres campus. People should know, like, David's often following me in the mornings when we're coming to carpool.
Yes. I'm the one who harasses you from behind with the insane honking and anything else I can do to annoy you.
Yeah, but, like, you harass me in this really cool new Jeep. Tell everybody about that.
For some reason, my dream car has been the old style Jeep Grand Wagoneer. And last fall, Lindsay was kind enough to say, hey, we need to do that and get one for you. So we are able to get one, and it's in pretty decent shape. Got some rust and some other things that probably need to be taken care of on the outside. But on the inside, it's pretty nice, and the engine works. I do pray every time I hop in it and turn the key to start it in hopes that it'll start for me. But
what year is it?
It's 1989.
Okay.
It's pretty recognizable. I haven't seen too many other ones driving around Orlando. And when we do, it's always like, oh, there's the car. It's awesome.
Well, I mean, it's super cool, and it totally fits the brand. Well, for y'all to know a little bit about David, he is currently the chief operating officer with the National Christian Foundation here in Orlando. Prior to that, though, David served for 21 years in the United States Navy, first as a helicopter pilot, and then a flight instructor, and then in public affairs. So his naval career, I mean, he was deployed to the Persian Gulf, Afghanistan, the Philippines, was a strategic advisor and media relations expert with the Navy SEALs. Man, you're so cool. He was communications officer for the Joint Chiefs of Staff at the Pentagon. And then just before his military retirement, served in a similar role at the United States Naval Academy. He has a bachelor's in mathematics from the U.S. Naval Academy. Dude, mathematics, like, I never put that together.
The thought of writing a paper in college was like torture. So I went through all the different majors. I knew I didn't want to be an engineer or a scientist. And the whole idea of spending time in the library. This is when, back in the day when you and I went to school, where you actually had to go to the library to do
like
research.
Card catalogs.
Yes. Yeah, that would have been torture. So I think I wrote like a paper a semester rather than my poli sci, my political science roommate, who was up weekly finishing papers.
Well, and the thought of a lot of people doing math in college is overwhelming. I'd rather write a paper. As much as we hang out and know each other, I didn't realize you have an MBA from the Naval Postgraduate School in Monterey. And then I did know this, and y'all, I think this is super cool. A master's degree in national security strategy from the National War College in Washington, D.C. Wow. David and his wife, Lindsay, have three precious children, and they've got really cool names. Tell us their names.
Sure. Our oldest is named Lofton Chapel. We had her when we were in San Diego, and she's destined for the stage and the spotlight. Our next daughter is Liberty Bishop, and she's pretty awesome herself. She's gotten into softball this year and loving it, being behind the plate as a catcher.
Yeah.
And our son is named Davidson Lion. He goes by Lion and has
Lion.
has the mane to boot.
Yeah, he's got some great hair. Yeah, my son Charles and Brooks, I mean, they've got some great hair too. Okay, so MBA and a master's in national security, like that, I want to hear about those, but if you'll tell us kind of the arc of your military career and even where those things fit in.
Sure. I graduated from Annapolis in 1998 and then went to flight school. It's about a two-year process. So went to Pensacola, selected helicopters, stayed in Pensacola for training, and then went out to San Diego to learn my aircraft. I flew the CH-46 Delta, the Sea Knight, which is the now defunct aircraft that the Navy doesn't fly anymore. It's a tandem rotor helicopter, so no tail rotor. Kind of like the Army Chinook that they still fly, the 47. Then I had the privilege of going to a squadron up in Norfolk, HC6, and did my deployment when I was in the squadron there. That was when we went to the Persian Gulf. We deployed, and at one point on our deployment, the captain of the boat had everybody on the flight deck and said, "Hey, we're extended indefinitely, and we don't know when we're going home. So let everybody at home know that you'll be here for a while." So
Was this like prior to Iraq and or yes. Afghanistan, and you found out like, oh, something's happening?
No, this was after 9/11. This was in 2002, like at the end of 2002, early 2003, as things were kicking off in Iraq.
Yeah.
We had a Marine Expeditionary Unit on board with a complement of helicopters and Harriers and the battalion landing team that was on board. So those folks got dropped off in Kuwait and went all the way up into Baghdad and had the bullet holes and everything to show for it, and came back unscathed on the march to Baghdad. So I did that deployment and then came back to the States and ended up transitioning back down to Pensacola and did a tour as a flight instructor. Did a year
like
and a
half. Top Gun.
No, not at all. I was at sort of the initial helicopter flight training for student naval aviators as they go on their quest to get their wings of gold. And then after that, I went to Afghanistan for a year and was on the air base in Bagram with a joint task force there supporting the Army. And that was in 06-07. So relatively quiet times there in Afghanistan when I was there.
And were you married through this time?
No, I wasn't married at that point in time. Lindsay and I knew each other, and probably that's probably one of the main reasons why we got married is because when I went on deployment over there, realized that she was the person that I wanted to spend my life with. And the pretty much the first weekend I was back, went and got back in touch with her and told her I loved her, and the rest is
smart man.
Three kids later, and
yeah,
never had a fight. Been great.
If you're watching on YouTube, you can see the smirk on his face that may not be fully true.
So, then after Afghanistan, I was stationed back up in the Norfolk Hampton Roads area and ended up transitioning into public affairs and spent the last half of my career doing that. So in the Navy, public affairs is strategic communications, a lot of media relations. That's one of the main focus and drivers of what we do. Also have a lot of time, or at least some time, working with books and movies and TV, all that kind of stuff at the very various different commands that we've been stationed at, and you're really connected with whoever's in charge, and advising them on how to either get into the news or stay out of the news, how to communicate with the American public, what the message is of what it is that we're trying to accomplish by being involved in a conflict or not, or whatever the case may be.
And then ended with the Naval Academy.
Yeah. So I did, as a public affairs officer, I started out at a strike group in San Diego, and then went to the SEALs corporate headquarters, so Naval Special Warfare Command, and then worked for the chairman of the Joint Chiefs on his PA staff, and then finished up in Annapolis. Mm. When I was a flight instructor, though, at that point in time in my career, I thought I wanted to get out, and I pursued the MBA through Monterey, through the Navy's postgraduate school. So I was able to do that concurrently and not have to be out in Monterey, and got the, it was really nice to have, when your life is so focused on one thing, it was all flying and learning how to teach and instruct and learning aircraft and how do you be a better instructor, and how do you help these flight students that are going through know what it is that they're going to face when it's their turn. And to have some time during that 3-year tour to think about business and to learn about accounting and management and consulting was pretty fun for me.
Now, where along the way, why, and tell us more about this National Security Strategy Masters.
Sure. So after I had become a public affairs officer and was working for the SEALs, got selected for my next rank for Commander 05, and the powers that be, the detailers, the folks that are in charge of where we go and when we go, selected me to go to the National War College. Each service has their own war college. So the Navy has a war college up in Newport, Rhode Island. The Army has a war college in Carlisle, Pennsylvania, and the Air Force has their command and staff college down in Montgomery, Alabama.
But how does a war college differ from like the Naval Academy?
So Naval Academy is an undergraduate institution. Each of the services, there's the Air Force Academy out in Colorado Springs. Annapolis is obviously the Naval Academy, and West Point is the Army's those are the three undergraduate institutions.
Then the Coast Guard have one.
The Coast Guard does have one, but yeah. I would remind you that the Coast Guard is a Department of Homeland Security.
Not a branch.
Yeah, it used to be in the DOT, the Department of Transportation, before Homeland Security came about. So,
okay, but then what's the difference with a war college?
So the war colleges are more of an advanced, like graduate level. Instruction and training. There's two different levels to become what's called a joint qualified officer at JQO. You go through a lower level instruction in strategy and tactics on at the war college, and then you can go to an advanced level where you get a master's degree out of it.
Now, if you're not in the field, but in public relations, why would they want you to get that degree?
So it's actually spread out across all of the different designators. So all the different, like I had a couple SEALs in my class, some mariners, pilots, ship drivers. So this is all from the Navy side. And then when you had the Army officers, and they were you had SF guys, Special Forces, Green Berets. You had guys who are artillery, guys who are engineers, infantry, the whole gamut of the specialties that are in the Army. And then we had Marine Corps officers that were pilots and naval flight officers, were infantry, artillery, supply officers. Same with the Air Force. You had bombers, missileers, fighter pilots, logisticians, supply, all the different services sent folks to the National War College. And then you also had the folks from the interagency. So we had a couple of folks from the CIA. We had folks from Treasury. We had folks from State Department, all the different governmental agencies would send a couple of folks. And then we also had foreign officers. We had about 20 foreign officers. We had, I remember this guy, Lasha from Georgia was not the state of Georgia, but the country of Georgia, the former Soviet Republic was in our class. We had some guys from Peter from the Czech Republic was in my, my cohort. So we had folks from all over the world that were part of our class.
Okay. Fascinating. And thank you for your service. Truly. Let's go.
Can I pause and give you a response that, not a former classmate, but a guy who was a 97 guy at Annapolis. His name's Clint Bruce. He has probably one of the best responses that I've heard for that. When somebody says, thank you for your service, his response is, you're worth it. And it's, and I've taken that to heart. I don't say it all the time, but I thought it's, it's a very appropriate response for why we do what we do.
Wow. That's cool. Thank you. So now your faith journey along this wonderful military career, your dad was a pastor, right?
Yeah, my dad's a pastor, still is. And I grew up in the church, so faith was always a part of who I was, or who I am. Funny sidebar, when I was stationed at Annapolis, one of my classmates and I reconnected and became kind of best friends again. We were able to go to the library at Annapolis and see our application. So, you know, you're in your 40s and you can see what you wrote as a 17, 18 year old kid wanting to apply and go. And I didn't realize, looking back, how deep my faith was even as a kid. Talking faith journey, you move a ton as a military member, at least most of the time, most people do. So every 3 years or less, we were moving. This is Orlando's actually the longest place I've ever lived. I feel, other than growing up. So that's challenging when it comes to faith, because so much of faith is getting plugged into a church community, and you have to be intentional about that. It just isn't going to happen for you. You have to seek it out, and you have to pursue a local community of faith, a different church. When I was in Pensacola as a flight student, I ended up going to a great church there and getting plugged in and teaching Sunday school. And
oh yeah,
when I went back 4 years later, I connected with the kids that I taught in middle school, Sunday school, were seniors in high school. And so I reconnected with those kids. And then I had a great church in San Diego. And when I moved to Norfolk to my squadron, I just couldn't find the local church that was the place for me to connect. And I really struggled during that tour as a result of the fact that I didn't have that local church community to be plugged into.
So you're actively going off base for such church community experience. I mean, but there are chaplains.
Oh, there are chaplains for sure. And there is a chapel on base typically, but what most people don't realize is that a lot of people don't ever live in base housing. I only did it once in my career. And that's probably not very unusual. Most of the time you live just like you, Case.
Yeah. Well, that's interesting. I did not know that. I do know that my parents were at Fort Gordon, which is in Augusta, when my sister was born. This was 1971. And my mother said, I will not have my baby in a military hospital. And so my dad went to the bank. He got a loan for $600 so that she could go to the private hospital.
Well, I would tell you that military medicine has definitely improved. I believe it or not, actually, all three of our kids were not born in military facilities. You have the opportunity to, with the healthcare that we have, to pursue care outside of the service. But when we were in, and we had great care. So, and the VA does a good job as well. So
yeah. So talk to me personally, like, what was the Lord speaking into your life through these many years of service and development?
Good question. You know, when I signed up to enter Annapolis, the world was a very different place. It wasn't, 9/11 hadn't happened. The Cold War was over. The original Iraq War was over. There was a little bit going on in Bosnia, Serbia, Croatia. But we were in a time of pretty much American primacy throughout the world. And so I wasn't really entering a world that I wasn't entering a military where I thought we were going to be dealing with like a 20-year career at war. So when I checked into my squadron in late August 2001, I didn't foresee combat deployments at that point in time. I actually hadn't even flown a flight in my squadron when 9/11 happened. And it was that was a pretty incredible day. We have 13 aircraft in the squadron I was in, and if you know anything about most squadrons, not all of your aircraft are up and available to fly at a time, just due to maintenance that's happening. Mm. And we were able to put 11 helicopters on board the George Washington, and it was steaming to New York that night to go protect the metropolitan area, because we didn't know what was happening. We didn't know if there were going to be other attacks or what, but it was, it kind of made you realize that there was more of a seriousness and severity to service than I think we realized at the time. And you always knew that you were serving your country. It just there gave more gravity to the idea of service and the idea of, hey, I'm joining something that's bigger than me. I believe in freedom, and it's worth protecting and fighting for. And that's my grandfather was in World War. Both grandfathers were in World War II. My dad's dad was a P-51 Mustang pilot in the Far East, and had a couple of kills. And my mom's dad was on a minesweeper in the Pacific as well. And then my dad served, and uncles as well. So service is in our family. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to fly as a kid. I saw Top Gun, and you want to go 100 miles an hour with your hair on fire and do cool things and serve your country. And so that was why I served. And you know, what was interesting about service is you realize that identity is such a huge thing. Hmm. And you have to realize where your identity comes from, and whether your identity is in the uniform you wear, the insignia that's on your sleeve, the pins that are on your uniform, or is your identity come from something more deep inside you, from a relationship with the Lord. And I had different things happen along the way during my service that weren't fun and kind of shake you to your identity. And you realize that I'm a child of God. I may wear wings. I may not wear wings. I may wear a certain rank or not, or get medals or achievements, but all that doesn't really matter, because you're secure in who you are. Mm.
I would imagine, as in life, that's a rare thing. You were surrounded by guys climbing the ranks that do put a lot of value into such
positions. Absolutely. And the military really is an up or out institution. I can't remember who I was talking about it recently, but they were like boggled by the idea that you get good at flying and then you don't do it anymore. You have all this money invested in you to become a talented aviator, and then you do it for 3 years and your flying career's basically almost over. And like, that's essentially what it is. Some have the opportunity to continue a career. But
why do they end it so quick?
Well, you have you go to flight school, you do your squadron tour, and then you might be able to be instructor, and then you can go back. But it's a winnowing process. If there's 30 pilots that are junior officers, there might be 10 at the next level, and then two at the level above that. It's just, there are so many other positions that need to be, have folks serve in, that it's just part of the career path. So it's a really interesting thing. In the civilian world, you pursue excellence and you pursue expertise. And once you achieve that, you want to maximize that for profit. And we have this up or out, you get good, you get selected, and then you move to the next rank and you compete against those folks at that rank. Yeah. And then you get selected for the next one. And it's a very much a pyramid, rank structure.
So Yeah, you mentioned grandfathers in World War II. Mine did as well. One was in the Navy, and actually the grandfather after whom I'm named. And he was in both European and Pacific theaters. They had a kamikaze Japanese plane hit their ship. They did not go down, but he said it took us about 2 weeks to get back to port. And the plane had hit and destroyed both their toilet paper and their ice cream.
Oh.
And he said, I don't know which one was worse.
Oh, for sure. And when I was on, when I was flying on my, off the boat on my deployment, we would do some supply runs. And so you'd pick up ice cream off the ice cream mail, toilet paper off the supply ship and bring it over to yours. And you just pray you don't have to, we call it pickle the load. If it gets out of control under the aircraft, like where you release it and have it go into the ocean. You, thankfully, we never had to do that. But, you know, the worst thing in the world would be to have to pickle the load of mail or something that yeah. somebody had to. Something sent.
I like that phrase, pickle the load. I may use that because I do too much. And so I need to pickle some loads. Because of that great tradition and that the family respect for the military, maybe this didn't cross your mind, but going into the Naval Academy, like, did you think about, okay, violence and what did Jesus have to say and with the ethics of military service?
It wasn't really a major topic around the dinner table growing up. It was more the idea of service and serving your country. But that's just kind of, it was normal. Like the idea of service was not this crazy thing. Like you're going to go off to war or anything like that. I'm sure my mom spent plenty of time on her knees praying for our safety. I think all three, I have twin brothers that are about a year and a half younger than I am. And I think there was a point in time when all three of us were not in the States. And I know that was a trying time for my mom. But the idea of violence and protecting freedom. I mean, I've been reading a lot I read a daily Bible plan, and I just finished Deuteronomy today. So you see God's instructions to the Israelite, and it's essentially merciless, like kill the women, kill the children, kill the livestock, kill everything. Don't take their stuff. So, God was on their side. And I think when you feel like you are in the right and have the moral high ground to serve and to do what's right, there isn't necessarily a lot of confusion or consternation over executing the orders that you're given, as long as you feel like there's a moral right to it and that you're accomplishing the most good.
I've got a lecture that I do on violence in the Bible and how to properly interpret and understand it, not to excuse it. But I think often Christians will point towards other faiths, particularly the Islamic terrorism we see, which obviously is such a small percentage and the outlier of Islam. But they will point the finger of, oh, how violent that religion is. And the fingers get pointed back to us. Yeah, but your own scriptures have quite a bit. So I'll post that in the show notes if anybody's interested to check out that
lecture. It would be super interesting to hear your thoughts on that.
Well, and if anybody does go and listen to it, email me. I'd love to keep that conversation going. So now your heart for service is very clear and strong. And that is a key component of Christian faith. Your father, though, being a pastor in his servant's heart, did you ever think about pastoral ministry?
No.
No. were you avoiding pastoral ministry?
End of discussion. No.
Yeah.
No. I mean, there's plenty of ways to serve, and I don't think that you can, you don't have to serve the Lord from like via the cloth. You know what I mean? As much impact can be made in the marketplace and how you are an example to others.
For sure.
In where you are. And I would definitely tell you that wasn't always me. So. Mm.
Tell, what do you mean?
So the military tries to be a cross section of society. So it's not just a white male population. We have, our, the goal is to be representative of the entire population. And so with that, you have people that come from all sections of society, from poverty and wealth, from inner city to farmland. And with that, everybody comes with their own set of beliefs, but the military tries to instill duty on our country in everyone and give everyone a reason to serve and a reason to believe, to fight for what they believe, for the freedoms that we have. And we've been the standard bearer across the world for a very long time. The challenge of, you know, in the most recent wars is the, you know, what's really true when it comes to intel and reasons to go to war, you know, with the Iraq war, you know, searching for weapons of mass destruction and the yellow uranium cakes or whatever that supposedly are some of the reason why you go to war, but is it really regime toppling or whatever? So there's all sorts of different conspiracy theories and everything else. But when you believe in what's right and believe in protecting freedom both here and abroad, it's not hard to obey the orders of those above you when you believe in the cause of freedom.
But you had made reference to there were some points where you weren't quite where you are today in that.
Oh, for sure. I mean, there are times in my life where I haven't been as plugged into the Lord as I feel like I am now. And your behavior and your life actions reflect that. And we're not where you're not as bright of a light to others and as you could be, as you should be. I mean, I've made plenty of mistakes along the way in my personal life that would probably cause somebody to be like, that dude's, there's no way that guy's a Christian. And then there's other times where it's like, I want to be like that guy. But I think that's probably true for all of us, regardless of whether you use it or whether you wear a uniform or not. So,
well, I know it's true in seasons of mine for sure. Now, a minute ago, you made the point that military engagement needs to have that ethical reason behind it. And I think that's what the citizenry are often looking for. So my eyes were kind of opened when in seminary, I got some teaching and did some reading on what's called just war theory. I'm sure you've heard of that in your master's program.
Maybe once or twice. Probably forgotten more than I ever learned.
Well, for those who may not be familiar, I mean, Augustine writes a lot of this. Thomas Aquinas adds even more elements, asking the question that when is violence necessary and appropriate from a Christian perspective? Because we've not only have examples of military campaigns, as we've mentioned, not always used as we think they might should be, but also in just appropriate ways, but also then how you deal with Jesus saying, turn the other cheek. And so just war theory lays out using Christian principles when it is appropriate to go to war. And so let me mention those real quick. If it's a just cause, meaning it is pursuing justice. And if it's a
in there on just cause real quick, I mean, we've even had Operation Just Cause. I think if my memory serves me correctly, that was, I think that was Panama. Back in the late 80s, early 90s.
Sure.
So.
And wouldn't you say, I mean, there's a whole lot of papers and wrangling and conversation in the Pentagon to work these things out.
Oh yeah. We don't go to war quickly, right? I mean, there is an entire industrial, like military industrial complex that moves to ensure that when we go to war, we're prepared to win, to fight and win.
Yeah.
And the whole decision-making process is deliberative and goes through so many different levels of just discussion. It's not something that's like, oh, let's go to war in Iraq. You know, not something like that at all. I mean, there's a huge decision-making process. And I mean, you learn it at war college, how that process works and the different levels of how those decisions are made and how the legislative and the executive branch work together. You know, we don't go to war without Congress authorizing it. You know, the executive branch, the president.
Technically, formally, but.
Well, I mean, yes, technically.
The president will label a lot of things a police action.
The president does have executive authority to carry out some action, but not unilaterally to have us go to war. There's the National Security Council and the folks that are on that, and principals committees and deputies committees. And there's
a lot.
You know, the chairman is the president's senior uniformed military advisor, and he's a four-star general or admiral that has probably close to 40 years of experience and has a staff of maybe over 1,000 people that support him.
Oh, good night.
In the office of the chairman of the joint staff is large.
Wow.
And the whole point of that staff is to support the chairman so that he can provide his best military advice to the president. And so he's there to give advice and participate in the National Security Council debates and everything else.
And speak into if this is a just cause. Let me mention the other six. So is it a just intent? Meaning, I guess your heart in the Christian language is in the right place, or your agenda is not for abusing a people group, but that for a better end. It's the last resort. So I would imagine after a great deal of diplomacy and conversation, this is a last resort. Fourth, legitimizing authority, meaning you are the head of the nation state. Now, I think that's been challenged a lot because in terrorism, well, what's the legitimate authority on the other side? Limited goals. And I remember George H.W. Bush was highly praised for his very clear limited goals in liberating Kuwait, but not taking the military to Baghdad. And there were some that wanted him to, and he held firm on those goals. Proportionality, meaning you engage to the degree to which you are engaged as opposed to scorched earth. Now, that's the big struggle right now in the Israel-Gaza situation. And then non-combatant immunity. And I think that means like villagers and people without guns should be left alone and not wiped out.
We're the fights against enemy combatants, and they're typically, there's the Geneva Convention, although terrorists haven't signed the Geneva Convention. Yeah. So it's really hard to apply those principles when your enemy isn't a party to the same treaty or principles that you're a part of.
Well, if folks haven't heard of this before, I just want folks to know, I mean, there is a tremendous amount of theological thinking and writing in the direction of the ethics of the Christian ethics of war. Now, some may hear that and say, oh, that's just a bunch of words to get around exercising force for somebody's national agenda, you know? But I'm grateful that we are at least in a country that struggles with these things and seeks to meet these things, as opposed to other countries we see in the world that have all sorts of motives that aren't necessarily pure. How did you see just war unfold in your career?
Great question. When 9/11 happened, you have essentially almost 3,000 innocents in the World Trade Center pass away. Yeah. Stock traders and office workers and everything else that are just going about their daily life and daily business, that two huge buildings are gone, lives are changed. Like they didn't ask for that, right? I mean, they just were going to work in the morning, and that awoke a sleeping giant, if you will. Like we don't take kindly to being attacked on our own soil, and we're gonna go get you. And it took a long time to finally get Osama bin Laden in Abbottabad in 2011, I think it was.
Yeah.
But that was a huge objective, was to take out the leader of Al Qaeda. Because we didn't want it happening again. The intent in my mind was to take out the head. Again, you take out one head, another will pop up elsewhere, and we've been playing whack-a-mole I think, for a long time. But I think when you live in a fallen world and people don't realize their need for a savior and who that savior is, then conflict is inevitable. And and we see that today, obviously.
Well, in closing, though, give us a little bit of insight on what you do today, because we love the National Christian Foundation here at the Collaborative and have an account there, I'm proud to say. But give us a hint of what you do there.
Sure. NCF is a national organization with over 30 offices around the country. Orlando is an affiliate that was started back in 2012. Tim Seneff founded it, and we've been here steadily growing generosity in the Central Florida region. Basically, what we operate is a donor-advised fund platform and help generous families be wise and better stewards of all that they've been given and help them with a giving strategy. Most people have a financial strategy, but not necessarily a giving strategy.
Oh, that's
so
good.
We come alongside families and help them with their giving strategy. We hope to simplify giving and help people be more strategic in the way that they give.
So. Yeah, I mean, that's great. Well, we will have a link to National Christian Foundation Orlando office in our show notes. So follow up if you'd like to know more. So David, maybe that means I need to have you on again and just talk about generosity.
Happy to do that for you too.
Yeah. All right, dude. So I'll see you around in your Jeep.
Sounds good. Maybe we'll see you in Carline.
Yeah, too often. All right, man. Thank you for being here. And I want to thank the rest of you for joining us today. Again, like and share helps us get the word out. And leave a review wherever you get your podcasts. You can go to collaborativeorlando.org for all sorts of further content, and we're on all the social media platforms. Don't forget our Formed for Faithfulness, a weekly 10-minute devotional for the working Christian that follows the liturgical calendar. I want to thank our sponsor for today, the Magruder Foundation. I'm Case Thorpe, and God's blessing on you.